Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business, the podcast that I do with Tom Uren every week, in which we talk through the newsletter that he has written, the newsletter of the same name, Seriously Risky Business, which you can find on Substack. Tom, g'day, how are you?
Good, Pat, how are you?
Great. Really great. And I'd like to thank this week's sponsor, RunZero, which does like asset discovery software. It's very good. It's basically Voodoo. Go check it out. Really awesome stuff. And I'd also like to thank the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative for supporting Tom's work with us here at Risky Biz, so that policymakers out there can be informed by Tom's wonderful analysis. And speaking of, Tom, you've covered two things this week. The first thing that you took a look at was the Russia's habit of trying to extradite Russian cyber criminals once US law enforcement takes an interest in them, right? So the usual pattern is some Russian cyber criminal, you know, gets arrested in Cyprus or whatever. The Americans are trying to extradite this person. And then the Russians say, well, actually, we want them for crimes as well. And they try to extradite them back to Russia. Now, the thinking out there in like Twitter and whatever is that the reason Russia is trying to extradite these people is because they're trying to protect They're cyber criminals who are also secretly doing their bidding. But, you know, you've taken a look at this, spoken to some people, and you think that's actually not the case.
Yeah, so this is something I've always been curious about, because the evidence for really close links between cyber criminals and the Russian state has never seemed to me to be exceptionally strong. There's definitely something going on. Like I wrote a piece ages ago about how a former criminal was employed by the FSB. So there's definitely something there, but most of the evidence is really amorphous. So I spoke to Gavin Wild, who's a Russia expert at the Carnegie Institute, a Russian cyber expert. And he was formerly at NSA and the National Security Council. And his view is that really Russia does this just because it kind of thinks that it should. Now, the reason I say that is that the way the law is in Russia, it's a way of exerting power for the powerful. So it's not rule of law as a separate thing. You use rule to give a veneer of credibility to what you're doing. Mm. And so therefore, when they see the US using law, they assume that they're using it as a weapon rather than as a tool of justice. And when your adversary uses it as a weapon, you need to fight back. And so they basically think that they're or want to be seen as equal to the US. And so their way of fighting back is to launch a counter extradition claim. And so it's all about just pushing back against the US rather than trying to protect any sort of secret information or protect links to the government. So that was Gavin Wild's view. Now he thinks that there are possibly links with the government and cyber criminals, but he also thinks that they're very loose. And
well, you'd remember some time ago I interviewed Andy Boyd from the CIA, and he described the relationship between, you know, Russian intelligence services and its, you know, Russian cyber criminals. He described that relationship as like a dotted line, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it. And I guess what you're saying is, you know, the same thing, or what Gavin was saying is the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. I think he didn't rule out the occasional case, but he said it would be the exception, he thought, rather than the rule. I think the phrase he used is something that they tolerate rather than orchestrate or control. Yeah. Now, he even went further, and he speculated that maybe they're a bit embarrassed about the whole thing, because it in a way displays weakness by Russian security forces that they can't.
Well, and you'd think that at the very least some of these people would have knowledge about corruption, right? And that's not necessarily something you want lying around in court transcripts in a hostile country, right? So there's so many reasons for them to do this. that aren't, oh, we've got to get our team member back, right? Like, first of all, it's you get to poke America in the eye, and, you know, any chance Russia gets to do that, it's going to take it. And I think also, yeah, there is that aspect of narrative control, right? Which is, see, we have rule of law. We can punish cyber criminals. We're not lawless. We're trying to extradite this guy, you know? So, it definitely stacks up. Like, it's dumb, but it stacks up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It made sense to me. It sort of fits the facts as I see them. Mm. And the facts are basically, you know, a loose knowledge of tolerance of cyber criminals. I think there might be the occasional, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and that's probably the extent of it. But if you get arrested overseas, it's nothing to do with us, but except for the diplomatic poking the US in the eye.
Yeah.
Which is the real value. So the other really interesting thing about the recent news, so the recent news was about a Russian called Nikita Kyzlitsyn. No doubt I've not pronounced that correctly, but he was actually arrested in Kazakhstan and the extradition process to the US has begun. And I think that's kind of significant because it's the second one in recent times where someone from a former Soviet has been arrested. And the former one was Georgia and they were extradited to the US. So I think it shows a kind of a weakening of the former Soviet bloc.
In terms of its unwavering allyship with Russia, yeah. I mean, it's that's interesting, right? Like there's this idea that there could be extradition battles between the West and Russia in places like Kazakhstan and the West comes out on top. You know, it is not what you'd expect necessarily. While knowing absolutely nothing about the politics of Kazakhstan, though. So I'll just put a caveat on that.
Well, I think that the default position, even though you know nothing, and I probably know, well, I definitely know nothing as well. I think the default position is that those countries would have once upon a time just done what Russia expected. And I think it's significant that that's changing, even in the absence of, you know, deep knowledge about Kazakhstan politics.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't need to be that deep to know that, well, you know, that's not what would have happened in 1978.
Yeah, that's right. These times, they're a-changing.
They certainly are. Now, the other thing that we are going to be talking about today is, there was one thought that I just had on that, that I just want, because it actually ties into the next thing we're talking about as well, which is, you know, we have seen more and more some of these Russian cybercrime crews sort of turning around and starting to do espionage, right? Yes. That is something that's happening. But even then, it's kind of hard to know why. It's hard to know if they're just trying to be useful and collect a bunch of info that they can pass along out of a sense of patriotism. It's hard to know if they're actually being tasked by authorities. It's just impossible to know. But it is just amazing to me the willingness of people to believe that there are deep links between the Russian cyber criminal underground and the state, right? It just really does seem like it's something people want to believe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so I also had that thought as I was talking to Gavin, and then I forgot to ask that question. And so my assumption is that there are these loose links. Links is probably the wrong word. There's these loose connections that occasionally are taken advantage of. But it's possible that the war in Ukraine has forced changes. So if that has happened, I think that's a relatively new thing and we'll find out in time, because I think there's now two groups that seem to have
done a
changed.
Hard pivot. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And you wonder, are they trying to get out from under charges? And that's the other thing too. You don't quite know whether they're all buddy-buddy or whether the FSB has, you know, said to them, well, look, we'll chuck you in prison unless you can find a way to be useful, you know? So there's just so many different combinations and permutations of what the links between the state and these groups could look like. And the reason I brought this up just now is because next up, we're actually talking about a Ukrainian hacktivist group that is now, so this is a little bit different because they're not a criminal group, but there's a Ukrainian hacktivist group going after Russian telcos and actually having a fair bit of success. And we're talking about these destructive attacks. One of them managed to knock down the ISP for one of Russia's like central transaction reporting bureaus or whatever, which caused a lot of problems. And this next one, the more recent one, they managed to, you know, brick a bunch of routers at a SATCOM provider whose customers include like the local government in Moscow and the FSB and whatnot. So, yeah. But first of all, yeah, we don't know that there's any state links on the Ukraine side. And second of all, you make the point that these actions don't really appear to be achieving much.
Yeah, so they're definitely painful. And I think outside the context of a real war where, you know, bombs and bullets are flying, they're actually really significant. So they disrupted financial transactions for over a day. Like, that's kind of big news when it happens. But when they just happen in isolation without any other sort of follow-on action, it's like, well, okay, that was really annoying. I couldn't buy my groceries for a day, but then life goes on. And it struck me that these are the sorts of operations that Russia would have liked to have carried out in Ukraine very early on. And they tried to, and they had some success with the Viasat disruption. But it's only when you combine them with some other sort of action that they have an enduring and long-term and actually really, I guess, geopolitically significant effect. And so even though these attacks were, like, by any measure, very, very successful disruptive attacks, they just kind of don't amount to all that much, or at least as far as we can tell so far.
Yeah.
So I'd be really surprised if these were Ukrainian
state-directed, yeah. Because, probably not, right? Because what would be the point?
Yeah, yeah. Now, it may turn out in the fullness of time there was some special operation somewhere that relied on these attacks. Like, I doubt it.
That'd
be amazing, but I doubt it. And I think they've just got other things to worry about that they're focused on right now. And the Grak and I have talked about this many times, about how it's quite difficult to align what must be quite a capable cyber activist group and get it to achieve something significant that actually makes a difference. So I guess this is something significant that doesn't make any difference.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. No, I just wonder why activists wouldn't try to do... You know, I get it, right? You want to get in the newspapers for bricking some routers at a telco, but, you know, I've often wondered why they don't just do collection, right? Like, look at what some of these cybercrime crews in Russia are doing in terms of pivoting now to intelligence collection. Why not just go do that? I mean, I suppose they could be doing that and we just don't know about it, but you do wonder, really. I mean, it's very hard to think of hacktivism that's actually achieved anything.
That's a really interesting question. I think partly it may be that they don't know how to tell anyone. like, there's no link to the security service.
What if they do espionage and actually collect something good?
Yeah. And I think maybe they're also, I wonder if it's a psychological thing. You know, you do this to feel good. And perhaps you feel better if you can see the outcomes.
But that's my point. It's all about making a splash and less about actually achieving something, right? It's about it's about feeling good, you know, and helping other people to feel good.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the part of what appeals about working in intelligence agencies is you feel like you're achieving something. Mm. So that you have that feel good, but there's this entire process around deciding what it is that you need to do to make you feel good, like an intelligence collection priorities list and, you know, national intelligence priorities, a whole lot of administration and bureaucracy to decide what it is that you're doing to make you feel good. Whereas I guess hacktivists can just go for the biggest, splashiest thing they've got.
Well, you make the point too that it's a little bit difficult to coordinate the activities of these types of groups, like hacktivist groups and whatnot, who are going to do destructive things for you. Because even if you had some destructive thing that you needed done, like, telling them about it is not exactly great for your OPSEC, right? Like, asking a bunch of random hacktivists, hey, can you go take down this telco, please? Is not really something an intelligence or military agency is likely to do just for operational security reasons.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's this funny dynamic where if it's important, they won't tell you. But if it's not important, that's probably where they'll get you to focus.
Yeah, which makes me wonder, though, but I just want to tie this back because this makes me wonder what possible relationship there is between these Russian cybercrime groups that have pivoted now to doing intelligence collection in the state. Like, are they actually being told, here is a target list, and is that an okay OPSEC trade-off? And, like, it's just the whole thing's pretty weird.
I think that if you're in a fight for your life, there's a lot of things where you accept a lot more risk. Now, I don't think Russia is in that situation, but it could be that they're just constrained in terms of capacity, right? And so here are some things, here are some targets we're not going to get to. And so, you know,
Whereas Ukrainian commanders blown. Are mainlining the good juice coming straight out of Fort Meade, right? I mean, it's true when you think about it. Like, the intelligence support Ukraine would be getting would be, you know, absolutely top tier, right? And the Russians don't have that. They don't have, you know, some big daddy SIGINT agency feeding them everything, right?
No, that's right.
Which is why they have to ask criminals and Ukraine doesn't.
Yeah, and I think they may be willing at that point to say, well, okay, here are third-tier targets that we'd still like to have info on and, you know, go and have at it. And if that falls through, we've not lost anything.
Well, it's a bit sad when that's your substitute for having the backing of the National Security Agency of the United States, right? Like, yeah. Choose your fighter, basically. All right, look, let's wrap it up there. Tom Uren, a pleasure to chat to you. Everyone should go read Tom's newsletter, Seriously Risky Business. You can find it on Substack or head to risky.biz/subscribe to find the link to sign up. Great work as always, Tom, this week. Really wonderful stuff. And, I'll catch you next week.
Thanks, Pat. Good talking to you.